Hello, podcast listeners. You are now listening to the Lifebook Member Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan River, and I want to thank you for tuning in today. On with the belief clearings, this time for Social Month. Parenting Month was powerful. I mean, it's such a belief-creating machine, you know, your parenting category is. So that was a very powerful one, and I think social is going to be right up there as well. Lion Goodman is back on the line. How you doing, Lion?
I'm great. Happy to be back.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much for doing these. You're providing a ton of value. People are loving it. Thank you. Let's talk. Let's see here. Let's jump right in. I want to talk about social connection. You're big on connection. The importance of it, man. It's so lost in today's society. You know what I mean? Can you speak on connection a little bit?
Sure. We're social animals, so we need connection. You know, if we were living in trees, we would protect each other and feed each other and groom each other. You know, now we don't do much of that.
Especially the third, yes.
Some people still groom us, but, you know, we pay them, hopefully. So my wife grooms me from time to time. Hey, change that shirt. That looks terrible.
But we've come a long way from spending all this time together. I'm sure that there were challenges that we're now facing that just simply didn't exist in the past when we were all living amongst each other constantly.
Well, that's true, but also look at the history of civilizations. People have wanted to live together. There's some real benefits to living together, even in crowded cities.
True.
One of the benefits is that it sparks innovation much more than people who are out on farms. You know, people who are spread out, there's not a lot of innovation. Things go slower. It's like it may take 10 or 20 years to innovate in one area, but in
point.
A city, it can happen in minutes, you know, with electronics, a new meme can come in and suddenly you're selling billions of cell phones.
Right.
When the previous phones worked just fine, except they were tethered. Now, what's interesting is that nobody had to tell people to give up their old phones for cell phones. It was such a better idea.
Right.
That it spread throughout the society and suddenly people don't need to be tethered anymore. So that's one of the big benefits of living together in close quarters. And it also causes tremendous problems like pollution and disease and all the rest.
Right. No matter what we do, we're going to face challenges, but we're facing new challenges, totally unique ones that we've never faced before as a species. So I want to talk about the ability to neglect these connections. What is that? I mean, why is that happening in your estimation?
Well, here in the U.S., I know we have worldwide listeners, but in the U.S., there's always been an emphasis on individual and individualism, right?
Mm-hmm.
The guy who goes out and conquers the market himself,
right?
The lone conqueror. And that's a fairly new idea. There were heroes in the past, but they were heroes for the community. Now we have individuals, successful people, or successful athletes, or successful actors or actresses who are doing their thing for them, not for everyone.
Kind of deities unto themselves.
Exactly. And we've lost the communal part of that formula. And then, of course, electronics have separated us even further. We used to have to talk over the fence to have a conversation with our neighbor. Now we can send them a text message. And we can send text messages to neighbors all over the world. And so there's an advantage that it multiplies the number of people, but it decreases the actual connection. And we need connection. Animals groom each other because we need touch. And people who don't get touched get kind of neurotic.
Do you feel it cheapens the interaction? Because it does allow, if you use it correctly, it allows connections that would never otherwise be there. But if you replace your current and historical connections with those, do you feel that it cheapens it?
I wouldn't use that word. I would say that there's a danger in losing the personal connection by using electronics as a medium.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. So you and I are having a conversation and I just said, well, I wouldn't use that word, right? Now, if you were texting me that information, I would sit on it and I wouldn't be able to correct you or say, no, that's not what I meant, or you misinterpreted me.
That's true, yeah.
Electronic communication can get misinterpreted very easily. People can get really upset for no reason, whereas if they were having a face-to-face conversation, they go, oh, no, that's not what I meant.
That's such a good point. I never really put that together. And also, why is it always taken to the negative? If you read a sentence and you don't know the inflection, How is it that even I find myself doing this? Like, I consider myself a pretty positive oriented person. Uh-huh. I'll be like, look at the way he texted that. That was sarcastic.
What a jerk.
Why is it? And I always remind myself, no, that's not what he meant. And you have to dig for another reason. What is it about technology where everyone assumes the worst?
Well, actually, that's part of the brain's mechanism. The brain's neural patterning is oriented toward threat detection. And in about 75% of the brain is oriented toward the negative and 25% toward the positive. Rick Hansen calls this Velcro for the negative and Teflon for the positive. So wow. We have a natural tendency to see things as possible threats and interpret them that way.
That is super fascinating. It's a survival tool, I'm sure, but it's not really serving us well when we're answering emails.
That's right. That's right.
We need a sarcastic font. I think that would solve a lot of problems. It's reversed italicized or something to indicate sarcasm.
That is a really good idea. And I want to recommend that you talk to the president of the United States about that.
Nice drop. That is not my idea. I heard some stand-up comedian say it, but I stand strongly behind it. I forget who said it.
Yeah, we have emojis, but now emojis are like, you know, oh my God, what does a tongue sticking out mean? Are they going, or are they asking me to kiss their tongue? I don't know.
Now, you are a language expert, so I'm going to take this time to just take a 2-minute diversion and talk about emojis for a second. The way that young people are communicating with these emojis are becoming like hieroglyphics, where they're putting three images back to back to back, but it's conveying a much bigger picture and much bigger message. Do you see this as the next evolution or a like side branch of evolution when it comes to communication?
Well, you mentioned hieroglyphics. It is like going back a few thousand years. We're using symbols instead of...
But I've also heard that it's the most efficient, that the hieroglyphics are in some way or another more efficient mode of communication.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, being my age, I did not grow up with emojis. My daughter did. And so she's quite facile with them. they kind of confuse me. I said, well, is there a meaning to that? Or is it just like
decoration? No, there's a meaning behind it always.
It's a truly generational thing. And I don't think I'm the right person to ask about it.
I'm fascinated by it because that's really where it's heading, is these images, and they'll paste a GIF or a meme. It still has text, but yeah, lots of imagery being used for communication, which I find fascinating.
Yeah. And the subconscious mind communicates in imagery. So it is tapping into a deeper level of the brain and the mind. The question is, how are we interpreting it? Like, you know, everybody knows about the new poop emoji, right? It's a pile of poop.
Right.
Is that like, what are you saying when you say that? Is that bullshit, or that means you're a pile of poop, haha, or you really are a pile of poop? I don't know what it means.
I'll fill you in line. We'll do a chat about emojis. I'll get you all caught up in the emoji world.
Thank you.
But I want to talk about how beliefs tie into all this. We're talking about connection. We're talking about communication. Where do the beliefs lie in this equation?
Well, beliefs are the filters that we see the world through. And we see all of the world through it, including our relationships. So if you have a belief, nobody likes me, what you're going to see in the world is people not liking you, ignoring you, looking the other way, not giving you the time of day. If you have the belief filter that says people love me, what you're going to see is people loving you, connecting with you, touching you, smiling at you. And so whatever our beliefs are about other people, they're as important as the beliefs we have about ourselves. And so the social beliefs are crucial to understand, to investigate, and to change where they're interfering with your life.
So I never really thought of this, but when you're dealing with relationship beliefs, maybe social relationships specifically, but all relationships between two people, is there kind of a feedback loop that occurs when you're dealing with two different people? So if you have a health and fitness belief, it's just between you and the lunch that you're eating. But if you have a belief that, for instance, I'm a boring person or no one likes me, you're going to be projecting that. And then when you encounter another person, they're going to receive that and go, oh, I don't want to be around this guy, and reflect it back at you. And now you've created your own truth. You've manifested your own reality with the help of someone else's perspective. That doesn't happen in all the categories of limiting beliefs. Do you feel that there's a feedback loop that occurs?
There actually is, and you're exactly right. So your energetic signature is floating out there all the time based on your beliefs. So if you believe I'm a victim and you're walking around like a victim, perpetrators are going to notice you because that's who they look for.
Right.
People with victim energy, right? So that's a relationship, even though it's a terrible one. Perpetrator and victim are in a relationship. Codependents attract narcissists, and narcissists attract codependents because they both agree that the narcissist is the most important person.
Wow.
So all of our relationships have these beliefs in them. Well, we have places like offices where people are supposed to be businesslike, but even then you get into power dynamics, power relationships, likes and dislikes, belonging, not belonging. So these are really core to our social animal brain, and we react to them. And then also, as you said, our own beliefs will radiate out and other people will respond to them.
Yeah, 100%. And when it comes to relationships, those are the ones that are really self-affirming, it seems. So super important. Is there anything you want to add? I have some questions about the exercise that's coming up. But before we move into that, do you have anything you want to add on social beliefs?
Well, I would just add that all of our beliefs are self-verifying. Because of the filter aspect, we see through them. And so we always see evidence that they're true. That's why it's hard to change beliefs or tell someone their beliefs are wrong, because all they've seen is evidence that verifies their beliefs. Just look at politics. The Republicans think the Democrats are insane, and the Democrats think the Republicans are insane, and you can't convince either of them of any difference, because that's all they see. They just see the insanity of the other party. So there's something is needed there in terms of belief change as well.
Yeah, and probably some labeling going on. So I think Lyon Goodman should go in there and clean it up. I think Lyon Goodman and Joel Wade combined could probably fix the American political system.
Good, let's get going.
God, Joel's like, no, please. Yeah, that's a really, really funny. Politics and happiness with him is a funny subject. But listen, man, I want to say this before we move into the clearing. I think this is one of the most powerful exercises you've done. I was about halfway through the exercise of this clearing when we began this call. This is really, really powerful stuff when you're talking about removing beliefs and practicing removing beliefs. So first of all, congratulations. Do you feel that this one is extra powerful?
Well, I appreciate your acknowledgement. And secondly, this is the core of the clear beliefs process. The clear beliefs methodology is composed of about 10 different processes. This is the core one. And it is the most powerful. It's the one that got downloaded into me. And it was the beginning of the whole clear beliefs methodology. So I'm happy to share it with your listeners.
Yeah, picked up on that. So listen, I was thinking about these exercises that you've been doing, going all the way back to Intellectual Month when you had us lay a pen on the table and practice applying and removing labels from a simple object. I've gotten better since that exercise. That exercise was tough for me. I had to try it a couple times. I was in and out. I wasn't focusing all the way. I am able to drop into those modes better having done more of these exercises. I believe it's a muscle you work out. I've also noticed my mind state really depends. If I'm in a bad mood or I didn't get enough sleep, I have a much harder time receiving messages, connecting with the universe, doing these exercises and having transformational growth. I'd imagine that some people might just be better than others. Some people might be a more physical realm oriented beings like I am. And then I think there are also more spacey, airy people who are much easier connect with the universe and get these downloads. Do you have any tips, any advice, anything to say to people who may be struggling with exercises like this, maybe at times, maybe all the time? Just any words of wisdom on that subject?
Sure. First of all, the realm that we work in with these exercises is, I call the imaginal realm. And basically, it's the realm of thought, imagination, ideas, visions, that kind of thing.
Dead on.
It's sort of like a waking dream state. Now, it's different than hypnosis. In hypnosis, you're actually caused by someone else to go into an altered state of consciousness in which they program you with, you know, different beliefs, right, or different actions. This is not hypnosis. This is an imaginal state in which you are in direct contact with the subconscious mind. And the subconscious mind, I say this in the course, but the subconscious has its own language. And so what we're learning to do is communicate directly with the subconscious through images and through feelings and sensations, not through words. And so, yes, it is a skill. It does build with practice. And the better you get at it, the more in tune you are with your own subconscious mind, the more you can hear it even during the day, because intuition comes through this faculty. innovation comes through this faculty, new ideas comes through this faculty. So we're building a muscle exactly as you said. And if it's a struggle, it may be because you're tired. It may be because, you know, you're ready to fall asleep and you miss out on the imaginal realm because you go right down into the subconscious, right into the unconscious. So just be patient. Try it a couple of times. If it doesn't work, it will work the second or third or fourth time you do it. And practice it on your own as well, as you're going to sleep, as you're waking up. See if you can hang out in that state, which is called the hypnagogic state in dream work. My teacher called it the warm and creamy state. You know, when you're not quite awake and you're not quite asleep and you're just kind of letting the reverie go. So that's another way to exercise that faculty, is just hang out there and daydream, be willing to daydream, because that's another way of getting there. So it is a muscle. It can be built. It's just a skill. We've all got the capacity and we need to exercise it.
I love it. And I like practicing it on your own, because I do these techniques on my own, and especially the emotional processing technique that you taught. But listen, I don't want to delay any further. This is really great stuff. Let's get into the clearing. Everyone, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time on the Lifebook Podcast. Lion, thank you so much, buddy.
Thanks, Jordan.
All right, everybody, enjoy the clearing.
It's social month, so we're going to talk about the beliefs we have about others, friends, family, community, and any group we identify with. We learn about being social during our infancy and our childhood, and we continue to learn about how to be social as we move through our teen years and into our adulthood. We learn from healthy relationships and also from unhealthy relationships. We are social animals, after all, and we evolved as a species from other earlier social animals. Monkeys and apes are incredibly social, as are other animals like dolphins, whales, wolves, elephants, and even birds. A large portion of our brain is dedicated to detecting and responding to social cues, because that ability to determine what the other person is feeling or doing is crucial to our survival. Much of our behavior, perhaps most of our subconscious behavior, comes down to one thing: our core instinct to survive. And here's how basic it is. A monkey or an ape that gets pushed out of its troop for whatever reason is basically dead meat. A monkey or ape can't live alone. It will quickly be eaten by a predator. Social animals depend on each other for care and food and protection. They and we are not designed to be alone. Our primitive brains know this, and yet more people are living alone now than ever before in history. And loneliness is a widespread epidemic in our culture. 40% of adults in the U.S. now live alone. It's like a gigantic social experiment. What happens when you socially isolate social human animals? The results so far aren't looking very good. And we have other basic instincts that come with being born as a human being, and many are related to this instinct of survival. For example, take the instinct to belong. We have a deep need to belong to our family, a clique, a group, or a community. We have a subconscious fear of being rejected, or abandoned, or ostracized, pushed out. The same principle applies. If I belong to the group, I survive. If I don't belong, I will die. Another basic instinct we have is to become like other people. You may have heard of mirror neurons. They're specific neurons in our brain that mirror what another person is doing. This gives rise to empathy and also the ability to imagine what the other person is experiencing. In primitive monkey brains, being like others equals safety, and being different equals danger. We treat those who are like us with kindness, and we treat those who are different than us less kindly. Recent research verified that the brain identifies these characteristics, and the social kindness circuit, the altruistic circuit of the brain,
lights up much more often for faces that share our characteristics than for those who don't. And if you become more like your parents, they will like you more. If they like you more, the less likely they are to throw you out to the wolves. Now, what's the best way to be like your parents? Observe them carefully and take on their behaviors, their mannerisms, their attitudes, and their beliefs. Most of us have two parents, so we pick up characteristics from both sides. Children are constantly experimenting with behaviors to find out what works to get approval from mommy and what works to get approval from daddy, and also from siblings, other family members, and caregivers. Children are geniuses at charming their parents. It's been shown, for example, that babies will smile to get their mothers to smile, and as soon as their mothers smile, they stop smiling. They got the reaction they wanted. Mother and child are constantly regulating each other and shaping each other's behavior. This is true regardless of what the family configuration is. A mommy and daddy, two mommies, two daddies, adoptive parents, single parents, whatever. The children are master observers. They take in everything their parents are doing so they can copy it and improve their chances for survival. For example, if the parents do one thing and say another, if they're hypocrites, the child will learn how to be duplicitous. If parents treat each other with disdain or contempt, the child grows up believing that that's how you treat people you're close to. If the child is beaten by the parent, they will grow up to beat their own children. That's the observed behavior. We're constantly teaching our children with our behavior, not just our words. Our parents also want us to be like them and believe what they believe, because their position is, hey, these beliefs worked for me, they allowed me to survive, so I want to make sure my child has these beliefs so they can survive and thrive. And this is where indoctrination comes from. A doctrine or belief is poured into the child, supposedly for their benefit. The Jesuits famously said, "Give me a boy for his first 7 years, and I'll show you the man." They knew that children could be programmed during those first crucial years and shaped into whatever kind of person they wanted to create. You can create a slave, or a freethinker, or a true believer, or a rationalist, or whatever else you want to create, if you can control those first 7 years of belief adoption. And of course, most parents have their children for those 7 years, so they're responsible for the most important education the child can get. It also sets the child's personality and their primal beliefs. Who am I? How do I get along in the world? How do I treat others? What is the world like? Is it safe or is it dangerous? Is it something to explore or something to avoid? In the area of love, as we talked about in Love Month, children learn what love is by observing their parents, how they treat each other, and how they relate to their children. The child accepts this as love. What else could it be? They conclude that whatever is happening is love. Even if it's mixed with abuse or neglect or abandonment or criticism, whatever it is, that becomes the definition of love. And when that child grows up, they will seek love from another person. And guess what happens? Most of the time, they will subconsciously seek out someone who will treat them the same way their parents behave toward each other and toward them as a child. Even if it doesn't look that way at the beginning, and it rarely does, it will show up later. Why? Because that person that they're attracted to feels familiar. They feel like home. And of course, the root of the word familiar is family. A girl who sees her father abuse her mother will be attracted to a lover who will eventually abuse her. Or a boss who's abusive, or friends who are abusive, because that's what love is, and that's what love does in her experience as a child. I want to give you a direct experience to do some self-research. Take out a piece of paper or open a document on your computer. I'll give you half a minute to do that. If it's going to take longer than that, put the recording on hold until you have that set up, or if you're listening while driving, or you're in a situation in which you can't write, please stop the recording and come back to it when you're in a safe place to write. Okay, great. The question is, what did you learn about love from your parents? Begin by writing, "Love is," and then say it out loud and listen to your mind, which will complete the sentence. Whatever comes up, write it down. For example, "Love is secure," or "Love is hard to find." Write that down, and then say it out loud again and write down whatever phrase comes up this time. Maybe you got, "Love is blind," or "Love is the foundation of life." You may hear it as a thought or a voice in your head, or something will just come to you. It's one of your beliefs or one of your deep programs. It's the way you see it in the world around you. So say it again, "Love is," and then write down the next thing that comes to mind. Okay, good. Now maybe you got, "Love hurts," or "Love is ridiculous." Continue saying that phrase, "Love is," and write down the next thing and the next thing over and over until no new phrases are coming up or the same ones start turning up again. Good. This exercise is called belief self-diagnosis. You're exposing your subconscious beliefs to your conscious mind, and you might be quite surprised by some of them. That's good. Keep going until you run out of new ideas. And turn this recording off anytime you want to keep writing so you can do a thorough job on this list, then come back to the recording. Okay, good. I hope you have many beliefs about love written down. Some people find 30 or 40 or 50 of them. Whatever number you got is fine, and you can always come back and add to the list when you remember others. There's more work to do to discover your relationship beliefs. We're going to do the exercise again. This time, write down "relationships are" and say it out loud and do the same thing. Write down whatever comes to mind and then say "relationships are" over and over again until you have no more new statements coming up. You may get, for example, "relationships are hard," or "relationships are a pain in the neck," or maybe "lower down in the anatomy." That's fine. Just keep doing it over and over again, "relationships are," and write down your list of beliefs. Good. You're going to do the same exercise, this time with "other people are." And the results may surprise you. You might find beliefs about people and relationships that you didn't know you had. You might notice patterns of prejudice or judgment, and that's okay. This is your chance to indulge in your judgmentalness and really bring it up from the subconscious and get to know it. You might hear the voice that says, "other people are idiots," or "other people ought to be shot." Whatever comes up, write it down. This is your opportunity to explore your social beliefs. If you want to go deeper, you can do the same exercise with phrases like "my relatives are," or "my brother is," or "my sister is," "my parents are," "my boss is," "my colleagues are." You can extend it to "my friends are," "my partner is," "men are," "women are," "sex is." Focus especially on wherever you have difficulty or trouble with other people in your life. And do this self-diagnosis with each person or group of people that you're involved with. So turn off the tape now and really go for it. Keep writing on each one that interests you until you've run out of new thoughts. Okay, welcome back. Here's the next step. Look over all your beliefs about other people, about relationships, and about love. Take a few minutes and review them all. And circle the ones that you know are giving you the most trouble. The ones that interfere with you having secure and healthy relationships that are positive and life-enhancing. Do that now. Again, turn off the recording and come back when you're done. And circle the ones that you know are giving you the most trouble. Okay, welcome back. Now, the next step is to go back over your circled list, all the items you circled, and pick the one belief out of that group of circled beliefs that has the most charge or energy. It's the one that has ruined your relationships most often, or kept you alone and lonely, or lost you valuable friendships. Now, for some people, it might be something like, all men are pigs, or relationships only result in pain, or sex is dangerous and must be avoided at all costs. This is called an interfering belief because it interferes with your life. And we're going to take one of your interfering beliefs through a process to clear it from your subconscious mind, which is where it lives and operates quietly in the background, or sometimes loudly, interfering with your life. I'm going to take you through an abbreviated version of the clear beliefs process to give you a taste of what's possible when you do the whole process with a clear beliefs coach. Okay, on a fresh piece of paper or on a new document, write down this one belief that's been interfering most in your social life. Put it in as simple a form as possible. For example, if it's something like, relationships are impossible because men simply won't commit because they're like wild, untamed animals, make it short and sweet, such as, men are animals. Think of how you might have said it when you were a child or when you acquired that belief. A child might say, boys are weird and icky. They probably wouldn't say, boys are only interested in sex, but a teenager could say that. Make it as simple as possible and also age appropriate whenever you acquired the belief. You can't remove a belief from just the conscious mind and expect it to disappear. To remove a belief permanently, you have to extract it from the subconscious mind, where it lives, and you also have to involve the superconscious mind, or the higher self. Now, our subconscious mind does speak to us, but not in a verbal language like English or French or Russian. It speaks in concepts and experiences, in metaphors, feelings, sensations and images, not words. That's why it's difficult to delete old beliefs with language-based techniques. You can recognize with your conscious mind that a belief isn't true, and you can even imagine who you would be if you didn't have that belief. Or you might try to impose a new belief on top of the old limiting belief, but none of these techniques touch the belief where it lives in the subconscious. The clear beliefs method uses the power of your imagination to speak in the language of the subconscious and clear it completely so it doesn't ever return. And this will all make sense in a few minutes. We're about to dive in. But first, think about what you would rather believe. If the belief you wrote down is, for example, boys are weird and icky, and you were able to clear that belief completely, what would you replace it with? Now, as a wise adult, you might want to believe boys and men and girls and women are all human beings, and they're all children of God. And just like me, they can learn and grow in wisdom and love. Do you see how that belief would optimize your chances of being a friend or a lover or a partner to such a person? And because you're growing in wisdom, your own wisdom and discernment would also be growing, giving you the best opportunity to keep yourself safe and get you into relationships with people of quality who are right for you. Feel free to use the belief I mentioned, but even better, come up with one of your own and keep working with it, changing its form until it feels really good and it gives you a good feeling about creating new relationships and improving the ones you already have. For example, I am constantly learning and growing, able to create wonderful relationships with everyone I choose to be with. Or, all my relationships are healthy and I can let go of the others. Find the very best belief for you and write it down. You can turn off the recording and turn it back on when you have that new belief. And in the meantime, feel what it feels like to hold the belief. Feel it in your body and look for one that feels really good in your body. Great. We're now ready for the process. Have your document in front of you that has the one belief you're going to clear and the new one you're going to install. We always do it in this order. It's like clearing the ground of rocks and weeds before you plant vegetable and flower seeds. That gives them the best chance of growing into beautiful plants. It's kind of silly to try to put seeds on rocky, weedy ground. So here we go. Settle into a comfortable position for an inner journey. Close your eyes and take a few long, deep breaths. Let go of any mental chatter, including thoughts of all those beliefs you stirred up. Just let them settle, like silt drifting slowly down to the bottom of a pond, so that the top of the water is clear. Now imagine that you're traveling to a very beautiful, safe, and sacred place for your inner work. You may have already created one during another process, and if so, go to that place. If you have contact with guides or angels or the divine, ask them to bring you to such a place. And if you haven't ever created one before, imagine a beautiful temple on a hill overlooking a turquoise blue ocean. Walk up to the temple or your sacred space and with reverence enter it and find a room where you can do your inner work and be safe and quiet and not interrupted. Now I'd like you to imagine that in this sacred room, there's a full-length mirror and also a container with a sacred fire in it. The mirror will offer you images, so all you have to do is look into it and accept whatever it offers. You don't have to make it up yourself. And the sacred fire has the ability to burn beliefs back to their original nothingness, so that there's nothing left, not even ashes or smoke. What I'd like you to do next is to close your imaginal eyes, the ones you have there in that sacred space. And once they're closed, say your old interfering belief out loud and imagine that it's 100% true. And feel what it feels like to hold that belief. How does it affect you? Even though the belief is about those other people, it has an impact on you. Feel that impact. Does it make you want to avoid those other people, or chase after them, or make them go away or disappear? Does this belief make you feel lonely, or afraid, or sad, or distant? Take note of whatever it feels like to hold this belief and whatever it makes you want to do. And it's okay if what you want to do is be violent or hurtful. You're not doing any of those things, and it's okay to feel like this. In fact, it's okay to feel anything. Really soak into those feelings, like soaking in a hot bath or a hot tub. Feel it fully. Thank you for being willing to feel the full impact of this belief on yourself and on your life. Now I'd like you to walk toward the mirror. When you get there, you will see yourself dressed in some kind of clothing or outfit, and just be surprised. Don't try to create it yourself. You might see only a part of it, or it might be fuzzy, so just relax and let it be whatever it is, however it is. Now, if you get more information from feelings, feel the weight of it on you. Feel the fabric's texture. Even feel its color. And if you just know things without visual imagery, that's fine too. However you get information is perfect for you. Take note of what it is you're wearing. This is how your subconscious mind is representing that belief. It may look like regular clothing, or odd clothing that you'd never wear, or a Halloween costume, or a circus outfit. It could look like anything, even a block of cement or a brick wall. Whatever you get is fine. It's your subconscious mind's way of representing that belief. And feel what it feels like to have that outfit on. Is it restrictive? Does it push or pull you in some way? Is it uncomfortable? Stifling? Freeing? Take some time and explore this outfit that represents your belief. And if you're not getting much information, say your belief again out loud and feel it, and then look again. Okay, you're always at choice in this sacred space. So is this a belief you want to keep, or is it one you want to let go of? I'm going to assume that you want to let it go, because it's a negative belief. So what I'd like you to do is to take it off. Now, every outfit has a way of being taken off. Sometimes you just strip it off like clothing. Sometimes you have to find a zipper or Velcro in the back and kind of scoot out of it from behind it and let it fall to the floor. Even if it looks like a person, let it fall to the floor. It's just a costume you took on. And take off all the parts of it. Make sure it's off of all the parts of your body. Now I'd like you to look inside the body that remains and take it out of any place inside of you that it might be lurking. So maybe it's lurking in your gut, or maybe it's in your brain or your senses, your ears or eyes. Look inside this body that you have here in the sacred space and pull out whatever remains of this belief. And you'll see it. Just take it out, strip it out, pull it out. And if you need to ask for help, just ask an ancestor or a guide or an angel to come and help you with this task. And let it all fall to the floor, just like when you took off the outfit, you let it fall to the floor. I'm going to assume that you have it out of you and off of you, and if it's still happening, just turn the tape off and start it up again when it's completely out of you and off of you. And now feel what it feels like to not have it on you or in you. Take a breath. Take note of the relief that comes from having it off of you. And now what I'd like you to do is to reach down and pick up all that stuff on the ground. Kind of push it together, mush it together, compact it so that you can hold it in your two hands. And then pick it up. Now walk toward the sacred fire and stand near the sacred fire, but don't put it in yet. We have a little ceremony to take care of. I'd like you to look at this belief and all the ways it's been on you and in you and controlling your behavior. And recognize that this belief has served you in some way, even if it's not obvious. Every belief serves us. It might have served us to become part of the crowd. Or it might have served us to align with one of our parents. It had something to do with your survival and your belonging and living in a good way in a social environment. So look at it and recognize that it had some value and it doesn't anymore. And you're going to say the following phrases to this belief before you put it in the fire. And feel free to modify the phrases if you'd like to. The first one is, thank you for having served me in my life. And you can say it out loud as you look at this belief outfit that's all balled up. And now tell it, I've outgrown you and I don't need you anymore. And now say to it, your job is done. And now say, I am now sending you back to the nothingness from which you came. And add anything else you'd like to say to this old belief that's been interfering with your life. And now, with reverence, place it into the fire, the sacred fire that can burn things back to their original nothingness. And watch it burn until it's gone, until nothing is left, not even ashes or smoke. If you need more time, simply turn the tape off and turn it back on when that's completely burned and gone. Good. How do you feel now that that belief is gone out of your consciousness, out of your life? Most people get a sense of relief or freedom or space for something new. Take a couple of breaths and feel what it feels like to not have that belief in your life anymore. And now I'd like you to remember or open your eyes and read your new belief and say it out loud. And feel free to modify it to make it even better. Now that you're freed of the old belief, you have a new vision of what's possible. So feel free to modify this new belief and make it better and better and better until it's spectacular for you. Say it out loud and feel what it feels like to hold this belief. Feel the possibilities it would open between you and other people. Feel how much love there could be in your life with this new belief operating in your subconscious mind. And if you held this belief, what would it feel like to be around that particular person or those particular people? And again, say the belief and feel what it feels like. Feel the belief fully, again, like entering a hot tub or a hot bath. Immerse yourself in this new belief. How will this new belief move you or motivate you or protect you or enhance your relationships? What possibilities will it open for your life? And now gently walk back to the mirror and look into the mirror and see or feel what this new outfit looks like or feels like. You don't have to create it. Your subconscious mind will automatically paint a picture. So just be surprised. Go see what you're wearing now. And take note of it. How would you describe it to another person? What does it feel like? If you want, move around, walk around, or even dance around in this new outfit. This is yours. Look around at this sacred place and know that you can come back anytime and do this kind of work anytime. And then walk outside and fly up into the air, just like float yourself up into the air wearing this new outfit, and fly all the way back to where your body is, where you're listening to my voice. And feel the outfit on this body that you have, where you're sitting right now. And again, imagine that other person or those other people and how you will interact with them wearing this outfit. How would you respond to them? What would you say to them? And what impact would your words have on those other people? Who would want to be close to you? Who would want a relationship with you? Still feeling the outfit and imagining those relationships, slowly open your eyes and look around. And just check to see, does the world look differently? This new belief will continue to deepen and anchor into you for the next 48 hours or so. So take good care of yourself. Now here's a fun thing. To enhance this belief in your life, go to one of the image sites like images.google.com and type in a description of this outfit. You'll find pictures that remind you of the new outfit or parts of the outfit. Print them out, make a vision board, or hang the pictures on your wall. Or even better, go shopping. Buy something that reminds you of this new outfit. Some people buy a scarf with the same color and texture as the outfit. Whenever you go somewhere where this kind of relationship might show up, such as meeting new people or being on a committee or going to a bar, remember this outfit and feel it before you walk in. I guarantee that you will have different experiences than you would have had with your previous belief, which has now gone out of your consciousness. You may want to burn the piece of paper or delete the document with that old belief on it and keep the new one. Write it down somewhere. This is a very brief example of the Clear Beliefs method, which goes much deeper when you're being facilitated by a Clear Beliefs coach. And if you want some support in changing your beliefs, visit clearyourbeliefs.com. We have many coaches you can work with in many different countries around the world. Feel free to listen to this recording over and over, clearing belief after belief after belief. Some people have cleared up to 200 beliefs listening to a recording like this. I wish you well in all of your relationships. Thank you for your attention and for your good work in consciousness. Until next month, this is Lion Goodman, Lifebook's belief clearing expert, signing off.